This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
The effort to pass a welcoming city ordinance in Bloomington has fallen apart again. Charlotte Alvarez of the Keep Families Together Coalition says the group is opposing the latest draft.
There are no reasonable restrictions on interaction between ICE and the police, and there is a reference to a policy, but there is no policy that we can see on how those interactions would be processed and handled.
GLT's Ryan Denham also reports Charlotte Alvarez says there's been little negotiation with the community over the issue in Bloomington. Plus, a photo exhibit at the McLean County Arts Center looks backward at Norman Rockwell and forward to today's society. And John Norton offers the music of Meg Farrell and Friends a different direction than the retro jazz of Sweet Meg and the Wayfarers.
All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A coalition of local immigrant advocates spent more than a year lobbying the Bloomington City Council to pass a welcoming city ordinance. But as aldermen prepared to vote tonight, that same coalition announced it was now opposed to the version being considered. They said it didn't do enough to restrict communications between police and federal immigration agents. They said it should have looked more like Normal's welcoming ordinance, which passed 2 months ago. GLT's Ryan Denham spoke with Charlotte Alvarez from the Immigration Project and Keep Families Together Coalition this morning. Hours after they spoke, Mayor Renner canceled tonight's meeting on the ordinance, citing a lack of support. Alvarez says it was a difficult decision to come out against the ordinance, but she did because it could have done more harm than good.
Well, the Keeping Families Together campaign has been advocating for the last 16, 17 months for a welcoming city ordinance, and we've consistently been saying the heart of a welcoming city ordinance is create reasonable restrictions between interactions between the police and ICE, and this ordinance doesn't do that. So we just do not believe it's the welcoming city ordinance that we've been talking about, that we've been debating, and the community has been advocating for, and we don't support it.
And your organization, the Immigration Project, provides legal services to immigrants in downstate Illinois. It's part of the Keep Families Together Coalition, which supported the town of Normal's welcoming ordinance when it passed in May. So as it relates to these communications between ICE and local police, what are the differences between Bloomington's and Normal's that left you guys so concerned that you're actually not endorsing this version?
Yes. At the Immigration Project, we're lawyers. We believe in following the rule of law, but we also believe in the power of the separation of powers in the Constitution. And the heart of an ordinance is what we're trying to get at is that separation of powers. We're saying the police should do their job, ICE should do their job, and it's really dangerous if they mix. It's dangerous because it loses all of the trust the immigrant community can place in the police, and it causes less people to come forward if they're victims of crime or their family members are victims of crime, which puts all of us at greater risk. So in Normal, we negotiated reasonable restrictions with police and ICE contact. We didn't get what we've been advocating for from the beginning, which is a complete lack of communication, but we got some reasonable guidelines and restrictions that are written into the ordinance and are backed up by policy. And that all has been negotiated with the city and with the chief. In Bloomington, that's not here. There are no reasonable restrictions on interaction between ICE and the police. There has been no careful negotiation process with members of the community. And there is a reference to a policy, but there is no policy that we can see on how those interactions would be processed and handled. There's nothing here that changes what the police is doing already or provides any extra protection for immigrants.
So what are those reasonable restrictions that were included in the Normal version?
So in the Normal version, interactions with ICE can happen only if a police officer goes to the chief or appointed designee and explains why that contact is necessary. And that official, the chief or his designee, have to weigh a series of factors. How important is that contact? What is the risk to the trust with the immigrant community? And how necessary is that interaction? And then that chief, in a written policy or written decision, decides whether they're going to interact with place. In Bloomington, none of that is present. The ordinance just says they're free to communicate and the police shall follow policy. There's no laying out of how that decision should be made. There's nothing saying that it needs to be written down, which means there's no transparency or accountability.
But aren't Bloomington and Normal both bound by the same federal law, which prohibits local limitations on sending, maintaining, and exchanging information about immigration status? What's the difference?
There is a federal law called 8 U.S.C. 1373, but it's actually very, very narrow. That law says that the local officials cannot restrict interactions with ICE in the sharing of immigration or citizenship status information. There's a whole range of other information that could be shared, and it's up to local officials to decide the interactions. The federal law is completely silent on all of those other interactions. So whether the police can talk to ICE about the location of individuals, their suspicions about that person, their family members, their friends, all of those other details about people that are so personal that the police might have knowledge of, that's completely within the city's control to decide how much of that information is shared and to make that distinction to gain immigrant and community trust.
My understanding is you're also concerned about Bloomington's proposed ordinance over its Section 3, which states that BPD does not, quote, as part of its routine practice, inquire regarding the citizenship status of those who either report crimes or commit crimes. So what is your concern here? And explain how you see differences between this one and Normal's.
There is nothing under federal law that restricts the city from prohibiting these questions or narrowing when citizenship or immigration status questions can be asked. It's just once you have the information, you can't restrict the sharing of that information with ICE. So it's safer not to have the information, right? And also, when you ask someone about their citizenship or immigration status, it creates this chilling effect because they immediately think of the worst thing that can happen with that information. Their citizenship or immigration status can be extremely private and it can rule their entire lives, right? So if you have a police officer asking someone, are you undocumented? What is your immigration status? That immediately creates a sense of distrust and fear with that officer, and that person might close down and might be less willing to ask other questions. So as is stated, the Bloomington Ordinance says they will not ask about immigration or citizenship status as part of their routine practice. That leaves the door wide open for them to ask about citizenship or immigration status as long as they don't do it every day all the time, right? And that's really in stark contrast to the Normal Ordinance that creates, again, the ability to do so when necessary, but it creates reasonable restrictions. And it also says that if an officer or any city employee asks about status, that individual will be told why. So it immediately removes the fear from that interaction and maintains that community trust and really makes that city official think, why do I need this? Do I need this? Is this helping me or hurting me to ask this individual about their status?
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm speaking with Charlotte Alvarez, Executive Director and Staff Attorney at the Immigration Project, part of the Keep Families Together Coalition. The group came out against the latest version of Bloomington's immigration ordinance, which is just removed from tonight's Bloomington City Council agenda due to a lack of support. Can you talk about the process that led to Normal's ordinance, which you supported, and compare it to what happened in Bloomington?
Sure. So the Keeping Families Together campaign came together based on a response to community need and what we really saw as something that needed to happen in our community. And we brought that to both of the cities as something that we think needs to happen locally. We are participating in representative democracy, right? We're advocating for those who are less likely to come forward and advocate for themselves. And so we have talked with both cities. The city of Normal welcomed that negotiation. We spent hours and hours talking with the city attorney, with the city manager, with the mayor, with the chief of police, and coming up with a reasonable compromise that really was based on respective dialogue, where everyone sat down with their concerns and then came to something that works in Normal. Bloomington has not done that. We have advocated for this kind of same open negotiation, but that hasn't happened. So really, there hasn't hasn't been that careful consideration of what could work that brings in community voices, that brings in immigrant voices, and brings city officials to the same table to come up with something that works for everybody.
Are you worried that if this version doesn't pass, nothing will? That Bloomington will just drop it and move on?
Frankly, we are. It was a very hard decision to come out against an ordinance after all this time advocating for one. But I think that the amount of time that we've been talking about this issue and advocating for this issue really shows a lack of commitment on behalf of the city to come forward with a proposal and to resolve this debate amongst our community members. We've had hundreds of members turn out. We had a large meeting in the BCPA back in November, and we still don't have an ordinance that is the result of careful dialogue. We really believe this ordinance, this version, does more harm than good because it assumes that the issue is resolved, but it's not resolved. And to call something a welcoming city ordinance that doesn't do any of really the heart of what we think an ordinance needs would give a false sense of security and trust to our most vulnerable population, and that's just not right. So we are concerned. We really want to continue the dialogue. We really want to have an ordinance that really welcomes our community. This isn't it. And so we just really believe that we have to say, if we're not going to do it right, we shouldn't do it.
What have your conversations with Mayor Terry Renner been like? He's supported the welcoming city ordinance, but your group is opposed to this version. Why even schedule this meeting? What's the logic there?
So Mayor Renner has really talked with the campaign and been a supporter for during this process with us. I think that he really has to talk for himself on why he's decided to put this ordinance forward and propose it at this time in this way. The best we can do is give our response. You know, it's within the purview of the mayor and the city council to decide how they want to do policy. They are our elected officials, but is also within our purview as members of the community and representatives of organizations that work with the community to say what we think of those proposals and that we should do better than what we have.
Are there any positives in this version of the ordinance?
There are a couple small positives in this ordinance. It says that the police will consider U visa requests, which are requests for victims of crime and violence who have come forward to help the police. The city will consider those requests and maybe help them in that process in the extent given available under federal law. There's also some great language about training that the police will learn about immigrant issues and the effects of arrest and the zero tolerance policy we have nationally. We just believe that really the heart of it, that interaction with ICE, isn't there. So it's just not quite there yet.
Well, this country has struggled with immigration policy for years, so nothing new in that respect. But in the last couple of months, the public's attention has been acutely focused on immigration, I think largely for this over the family separation issue at the border. At the same time, we've seen a lot of local attention paid to this welcoming ordinance issue. I guess I want to ask, what have the past few months been like for you, someone who works in this field day in, day out, to see the public's attention turn this way to immigration?
Really, I think the public's attention has been turning to immigration because of the heart-wrenching stories we've seen nationally about the zero tolerance policy and the shift in our immigration policy towards a regime of harsh enforcement. There's always been need for comprehensive immigration reform. That need is still there. But then in the current day and age, we've seen just terrible stories of families being ripped apart. We've seen heard audio of kids crying in detention centers separated from their families. And there's photos of mass criminal processings of immigrants on the border. They're processing 45 to 60 individuals in one morning for criminal offenses that really is skirting our Fourth Amendment due process rights in a major way. So I think this attention on immigration is coming from a place of concern for the immigrants who are stuck in this system and a really outrage over the lack of humanity in our current system. As attorneys working within the system, it was really heartbreaking to see. I think there's often a disconnect between national policy and individual people who are stuck in that policy. So we talk to people, we tell them their legal options, and sometimes the legal options are there's no way for you to become a citizen. There's no way for you to be reunited with your family. There's no options here. And that's just really heartbreaking to see. So we try to find options for people. Sometimes there's ways under the law to be reunited or to stay in the United States. But a lot of people are left in the cold by immigration policy. And those are people that most of America doesn't see, right? They're people in the shadows who are trying their best to live their lives and stay together with their families. And we see them. That's why we have kind of this impetus to come forward and advocate for the people that we serve, because we believe that they need a voice. And in this national kind of this national moment, it's so hard for them to have the courage to come forward and voice for themselves what's happening to them. And so we as allies need to step forward and kind of advocate for them.
It's Charlotte Alvarez, Executive Director and Staff Attorney at the Immigration Project, part of the Keep Families Together Coalition. The group came out against the latest version of Bloomington's immigration ordinance, which is just removed from tonight's Bloomington City Council agenda due to a lack of support. I'm Ryan Denham.
The city says future meetings on the topic are not expected. Mayor Terry Renner says he instead wants Bloomington's police chief to establish policies and procedures for how officers interact with federal immigration agents.
Support for GLT comes from Community Players Theater, presenting Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, a timely and timeless biblical saga set to an engaging cornucopia of musical styles. Details and tickets at communityplayers.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, an art exhibit, a waft of nostalgia coupled with contemporary issue sensibilities at the McLean County Arts Center. Governor Bruce Rauner is eating some crow and apologizing. That's a rare occurrence, according to the Illinois Politics Roundtable. Brian Mackey moderates the panel today with Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, IPR's Daisy Contreras, and Mark Maxwell, the Capitol Bureau Chief for WCIA-TV, serving Springfield, Decatur, and Urbana-Champaign. Daisy Contreras recaps how the fracas began a couple weeks ago with remarks on a Chicago radio station.
Yeah, so Rauner blamed the University of Illinois for not being able to retain its grads, many who have founded companies near California, Silicon Valley now. He placed this blame on Champaign-Urbana, saying that it's hard to keep a company of more than six people. They are due to, and according to him, to a lack of convenient transportation, a lack of a workforce, which drew ire from many in the area, from lawmakers to people in the community. And like you said, Brian, later, the governor said his words were taken out of context. And this week he began his so-called apology tour in Urbana-Champaign.
Yeah, and I mean, the U of I is known for some, you know, pretty famous tech companies that have been started by graduates. I think PayPal is one that's often mentioned. I think I might have lived in the dorm with the guys who founded Yelp at one point. Didn't know him personally. But Mark, you were there as the governor showed up in Champaign-Urbana this week. Can you tell us what was that like?
Well, it was one of the more memorable moments I can remember from covering this governor at all, because it really was a testament to the pride that the people of Champaign-Urbana feel about themselves, about their workforce, about their city, about the university. I call it a grassroots fact check in real time, so to speak, because it just so happened that on a Wednesday night when the governor was staying, or a Tuesday night, I believe it was, staying overnight in Washington, D.C., and we first sort of discovered these comments that were online and started asking questions to the governor. What did you mean when you said that Champaign-Urbana has, quote, not much of a workforce and can't keep a company of more than six people? Well, on that night, the mayors of Champaign and Urbana and the Champaign County Chamber of Commerce and a whole bunch of business development folk were also in Washington, D.C. And so as fate would have it, the governor had to face his own comments face-to-face from the mayors that night. And I think that stroke of luck, if we can call it that, also helped to precipitate the governor's apology, because I've talked to a lot of reporters and different political observers and people in the State House. And Brian, I can't find anybody who tells me that they've seen the governor so quickly apologize for something that he said like that. But it really forced him to face his own words and meet with several of the different companies and who in their by their existence prove the governor's comments were false.
And he has, these are companies he has visited. I mean, he's done press events. I saw that in the Champaign News Gazette, Tom Kasich, a columnist there, listed off some of the press events that he has done as governor in the past few years at Champaign Urbana cities.
And that was part of, I think, if we're putting the governor's, if we're giving him the full benefit of the doubt and putting his comments in the context that I think he was trying to say, it was that some of those companies you listed off, like iTunes and YouTube and Tesla Motors, some of their founders and co-founders, you know, came from U of I. They just so happened to settle at a place called Silicon Valley, which I think that was sort of established long before as sort of a haven for tech startups and companies, long before the governor ever came to Illinois. And he was sort of pointing to a larger problem and sort of awkwardly comparing Champaign to Chicago, Champaign to Silicon Valley. And the governor obviously regrets those remarks now. But the interesting thing is the Champaign happens to be the fastest growing city in the entire state with jobs, with population. And so it's really a bright spot. And I think he learned that lesson over the week.
Well, and it was also interesting that he talked about the transportation, because in fact the mass transit district in Champaign-Urbana has won recognition as one of the best mass transit districts in the whole country by a national organization of like highway and transportation professionals. And so for him to diss it like that, and of course there's only three interstate highways that run through Champaign.
Charlie, I also wanted to ask you about something that Mark mentioned, which is that people under the statehouse are not used to hearing apologies and sort of takebacks from this governor. Did that strike you as this is something relatively unusual here?
Yeah, the quickness of it and the fact that he did apologize, although he says, well, my remarks were taken out of context. We heard the clip of him actually saying this stuff at the beginning of the show, and it brought to mind, and this really does date me, Mayor Richard J. Daley, back in the day, he had a press secretary whose name was Earl Bush, and he once upon a time chided reporters, don't report what he says, report what he means. and so apparently you have to try and guess what the governor is trying to say when he actually says something. But yeah, it is. It's probably the first time he's been willing, certainly that quickly, to admit that, yeah, he put his foot in it.
And, you know, and this kind of sort of reminds me of J.B. Pritzker's apology tour in February with African-American communities after his racially charged statements that, you know, he made to then-Governor Rod Blagojevich back in 2008 and the conversations that were leaked. That's how we got, you know.
This is the wiretap recordings.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah. So Pritzker went around visiting churches in his effort to reach out to those black voters. And I remember he said something along the lines of, that was not my best self.
Yeah, of course, J.B. Pritzker needed black voters in the primary more than probably Governor Rauner needs a handful of, you know, voters who I think Champaign-Urbana city core is probably, you know, going to vote Democratic. But go ahead, Mark.
The funny thing about that, actually, is during the primary, if you look at the vote tallies, Champaign-Urbana gave Governor Rauner, if you split the map up geographically, the strongest support base he has in the entire state came from Champaign-Urbana and central Illinois at large. So that was the area that if they didn't carry him over the finish line, they certainly padded his lead in that close primary against Jeannie Ives. So I think this actually is an area of some moderate people. Yes, they'll vote Democratic sometimes, but these are also people that Governor Rauner has prided himself on connecting with downstate. And I think that may have also been one of the really big motivating factors fueling his apology tour.
Mark Maxwell of WCIA-TV, along with IPR's Daisy Contreras, Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois at Springfield, and today's Illinois Politics Roundtable moderator, Brian Mackey.
Support for GLT comes from the Community Cancer Center, a partnership of Advocate Bromen and OSF Healthcare, offering the latest technology and diagnostic services and cancer treatments, along with time-honored traditions in supportive care. Located at 407 East Vernon in Normal. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, Sweet Meg and the Wayfarers becomes Meg Farrell and Friends. John Norton has that. Photographic artist Maggie Miners is exhibiting at the McLean County Arts Center, revisiting Norman Rockwell by weaving into each photograph the social issues and elements more suggestive of today. Miners says in this Skype interview she thought before she started that Rockwell was accessible to many people and would stimulate discussion among the general public, not just the art set. Miners says she thinks that's true in spite of increased urbanization and a shift away from the American nostalgia Rockwell portrayed so well.
You know, I know from my research that his paintings were based on his observations of America at the time. You know, I tried to be as true to that from my perspective as well. I think the big insight for me was that it looks like things change, yet in many ways they remain the same, which is kind of the rhetoric for the moment, I think.
What has not changed?
There are a lot of issues that still exist today that Rockwell had touched upon as early as 1941 with his Four Freedoms and, you know, segregation.
Freedom from want, freedom from fear, were a couple of the others.
Yes.
That, interestingly, is part of the monument outside the McLean County Museum of History, is those Four Freedoms.
Oh, that's so interesting. I have to say I did not notice that. I wish I had. I would have taken a picture of it.
How have you tried to reimagine and reinterpret Rockwell through your photos? What do you do? Explain that to the audience, would you?
Basically, I came up with an idea. The first one that I really came up with was the Freedom from Want, which is the Thanksgiving table one. It was during the time of the Proposition 8 out in California, and I had... My kids saw that painting, and we were having a discussion about what was going on in California because we had some family members that were really involved in that, you know, moving that where they wanted it to go. And we talked about what constitutes a family today. What is a family? What does family mean to you? What do you think family means to other people? And then why does a court get to decide what a family is, or where love is coming from, or how to define a family? So I just sort of flippantly said to my husband, wouldn't it be interesting to take this painting and turn it into a photograph that represents, you know, a gay family? And he said, yeah, you should do that. So that was the impetus of all of it. It took about 8 years because I had to research Rockwell. I knew his work, but I didn't know a lot about him. And during that time, a biography had come out, and I just learned more about his work and really dove into images that I had never seen and how did they relate to me and the world as I see it today.
Rockwell worked from photos. He worked from posed positions. He worked from lots of different I won't say contrived, but arranged things. How is that similar to your process or different?
Well, it's interesting because it's very similar in that I was working strictly from his paintings. I took his interpretation and it was fairly simple to direct my models because he had the positioning all set up for me. So all I had to do was really work from the image and create my own set design and styling and costumes and that whole thing. So in a way, we sort of reversed roles. You know, I worked from a painting that he worked from photographs and that kind of thing. And we both also used models that were friends and family. I had never worked with humans in this capacity in my art, so it was a little intimidating to me. So I was much more comfortable using people I knew rather than hiring out. But towards the end, I started hiring models and going out of my comfort zone for the sake of art and for the sake of the message.
Did you have some of the same sensibilities in your own work before you took this particular project on that Rockwell had?
I think the most similar sensibility was just observing life from our personal perspective and somewhat owning that. So the work that I had done previously was really my observations from a more cultural perspective of the people I hang out with. It came from the place of not being able to hear very well and being able to use the way people dress and their mannerisms to identify certain socioeconomic demographics. In that way, we both just kind of worked with what we work with, what's familiar to us.
Rockwell often had a strong component of humor in his work, especially for the Saturday Evening Post, whether it's the diptych of the family going out on a trip to the beach with everybody excited and full of energy and sort of crisp looking, and the mother-in-law very dour and put together in the back seat, and then coming back where everybody is bedraggled and worn out and much the worse for wear, except for the mother-in-law, who is clearly the same. There's the story, there's the image of the boy with a beautiful shiner, black eye, and grinning at having won the fight. There are lots of different humorous images. How did you try to work humor in your project?
Well, it was sort of easy to identify which of his were humorous, so I just kind of took that and went with it. I think that some are obviously more humorous than others, I think I kind of just used him as a guide.
You also did the portrait of the artist thing that he did as well.
Oh, yeah, I thought that was funny.
Yeah. What did you find out in doing that one?
I mean, I found out that I have a really hard time looking at that one, to be honest. I mean, it's a lot of me. And I think there's a little sense of being an artist. I'm not going to speak for all artists. I'm just speaking for myself. I mean, there is a little bit of self-centeredness, not necessarily negatively, but we're often sitting with our own thoughts and thinking of ways to execute that. So to just, have that on top of like these visual images of myself, it just is like, I think it's funny. I think his is funny. And I also think it's kind of dark in the sense of like social media and camera phones and selfies, and it's just really, really sad.
What are you hoping people at the McLean County Arts Center come away with from viewing your works in this exhibit?
I'm hoping that people connect with one another through conversation. If one of the images resonates because their parents got the Saturday Evening Post their whole lives as children, they can share those stories with one another. I really try to make art that connects people, where people can share similar experiences. Most of my art is about deconstructing American culture and artifacts and iconography. So I think just having that as a basis naturally will connect people in some way. So that's my hope. It's just that it fosters conversation and connection, and people aren't afraid to look at art or talk about art because it's accessible.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker talking with Maggie Miners, who has an exhibit at the McLean County Arts Center, Reimagining Norman Rockwell. One of the images has gone viral recently. It has been a very interesting conversation on Instagram. How did that happen?
Well, Jennifer Garner, the actor, reposted the image called Dream Act of the little girl being escorted by Border Patrol.
Mm-hmm.
And she credited me and explained it was a reinterpretation of Rockwell. Well, then Gal Gadot, Wonder Woman herself, reposted the image, and she thought it was real, and she didn't credit me. So the dialogue that continued on her Instagram feed was really, really interesting from a social perspective, you know, just because A, she thought it was real. Then there were artists that were like, you need to credit the person. And then there were people like, those aren't real uniforms and there'd never be graffiti in a detention. I mean, it just was so interesting. And then there was a lot of dialogue about Israel and Palestine, and she has no business getting into politics. So it was sort of an interesting, definitely what I wanted to happen. I just don't necessarily know, you know, if social media was a place I would have liked that to happen.
How would you have preferred it to take place?
You know, I think it would be with a very good moderator. I think some of these images, well, especially this immigration one, it would be really great to have perhaps someone who lives at the border, someone who is working for immigration services at the border, a legal immigrant, an illegal immigrant, a person that's family's been here for 5, 6, 7 generations. I mean, just getting all these different people from different backgrounds together to discuss immigration.
Isn't, for better or for worse, though, social media the place where that discussion happens nowadays?
I mean, I'm beginning to think so. But I don't think it resolves anything. I feel like I answered a couple of the people that had really, you know, just not very nice things to say, not necessarily about me or the image. I mean, it's purposely very ambiguous, but just, you know, one person said it, you know, this image, this is taken from a place of privilege or something like that. And my response was like, you're absolutely right. I have had a very privileged upbringing and I own that and I acknowledge that. And all I try to do with that is use that for the common good and try to help connect people and, you know, and just like not feeding into the toxic and negative of it, but being like, hey, yeah, obviously this picture provoked you. So let's talk about that. Like, why does it make you so mad? And that kind of thing. So I just, it is, you're right, for better or worse, it's too bad that it takes place on there because it seems like a little less of a dialogue. But some of the responses I've made, I feel like people were like, ah, okay, great. They weren't defensive comments. It was just like, hey, this is where I'm coming from and I hear where you're coming from. And you know, we both acknowledge this is a problem. Maybe we can figure out a way to create a solution.
One of the great powers of art is to disturb. And you're going for that in a way. Did Rockwell go for that? It seemed he was often more conventional. And when he went for disturbance, it was more muted or more suggestive than overt, it seems.
Yeah, I do think that one of the powers of art is to be able to disrupt, you know. And with this particular image, you know, the meaning has expanded since 2016, whenever the elections were, I've lost track at this point, but, you know, the meaning's expanded. I originally made that, and it's called Dream Act. During the Obama era, I remember during that time, there was this question of what is going to happen with these kids with the Dream Act? Are they going to be allowed to stay? Are they not? And that whole thing. So I made the image pretty much based off Rockwell's, but also with the ambiguity, is the little girl coming or going? Is she being protected or is she not? And that was the question at the time, or at least that's the way I saw it. So it was really ambiguous. And then, you know, since things have changed a little bit, the meaning of the image has changed a lot, and it's actually become more disruptive.
Why? I mean, only the context of the conversation in public has changed, right? The image hasn't changed.
I don't know why, because it's the same image. I just think the meaning is different. I think people are just, maybe they're paying closer attention. I think overall, as a culture, our anxieties have increased. There's a lot more fear we're living in. there's a lack of trust among neighbors. You know what I mean? Like, I think that it's just become very volatile in the past 18 months.
That's Maggie Miners, the artist whose exhibit Revisiting Rockwell is at the McLean County Arts Center through the end of the month. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org and Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The woman who fronts the hot jazz band Sweet Meg and the Wayfarers with Normal native and saxophonist Ryan Weisite says a desire to tap into her folk and country roots was the impetus to morph into a different lineup with a new name. Meg Farrell and friends will appear on the Night Shop sign ahead of Wednesday's show from her home in Brooklyn. Farrell tells GLT's John Norton via Skype that Sweet Meg is still a thing, but as a desire to tap into country influences, including Patsy Cline, forced her hand.
I was bringing more and more country music to Sweet Meg because I wanted to do just play it. And, you know, I was doing all these Patsy Cline songs and I was learning Emmylou Harris songs and I wanted to sing them. And then I also really wanted to start doing my original material again because it had been a while and I was kind of missed it. And I realized I was like this. I tried to do it with Sweet Meg and I was like, this really doesn't fit with this band. Like, I love Sweet Meg and the Wayfarers, but it doesn't fit. So I started a new one, and then this band, it all fits. So
is it country and hot jazz that doesn't really mix together, or is it the kind of country and the kind of jazz that you're doing that don't mash well together?
Mainly the country and the hot jazz. There's, like, a lot of the tunes, like, some of the earlier stuff we do, like the Patsy Cline stuff, I worked with Sweet Meg, and I still do that stuff. But the more, like, rockin', that more of the 70s stuff we're doing, like, it's electric, you know, and that's, like, kind of why it's so awesome and fun. And Sweet Meg is so thoroughly not electric because it's, you know, it's old time jazz. It's acoustic.
Well, it sounds like Billie Holiday was a huge influence on you when you were growing up, at least on the jazz side. Who would you say on the folk pop rock side was in your CD collection that really smacked you upside the head? Or country as well. Was it Patsy Cline and Emmylou Harris and people like that?
I've been a big Patsy Cline fan as long as I've been a Billie Holiday fan, pretty much. But I worked at a record studio when I was in high school, and I was like the intern, and I cleaned out the basement for this producer, and I remember I found all these CDs and he just said, if you want any of them, just keep them. And I found this Patsy Cline Greatest Hits, and it was like this one CD I had for a while, and I just like memorized almost the whole CD. I didn't realize it until like I started playing the songs that I knew all these Patsy Cline songs already, and how much memorizing that album actually had already affected my voice. Like, I, you know, a lot of the little isms or whatever that I do come from Patsy Cline, you know, and I didn't realize her influence over me had been stronger than I'd given her credit for.
So the new album is out in September. Fear Nothing came out a couple years ago. So is there any crossover from Fear Nothing into your new band or vice versa?
To me, there always is crossover because it's my music, my original stuff. And so I feel, you know, there's a lot of things that are similar, similar ideas. But there's a very different instrumentation. I mean, not hugely different, maybe for me. But I think that album was more of a... my original music, and I put musicians together and we kind of figured out how to orchestrate an album versus this, where now we finally have a band and it's like a set group of people and we gig a lot together and we're kind of have a relationship together with how we play the songs. And so we recorded, basically just captured that.
The people were saying no to ever. But one had sorrow that never was said.
She Moves Through the Fair is a song from No Fear. It's our guest, Meg Farrell, and friends. Part of those friends is Ryan Whiteside, the Normal Native. He and Meg have been together for a long time now. Ryan, when we saw you and Meg in at the GLT Summer Concert, it was Sweet Meg and the Wayfarers. It was the jazzy side, the hot jazz side. What for you as a saxophonist, now looks like playing bass in this band? How is this working for you? Is it a nice change of pace for you?
Yeah, it's really fun, and it's challenging because I've been playing bass for, I think, about 8 or 9 years now. I kind of picked it up just as a hobby because, you know, I'd be in my apartment and I couldn't play my saxophone late at night because it's too loud. And so I thought, well, if I got a bass, I could just run it through some headphones and I can play as late as I want. I'd been in one band before on bass, but then this kind of just arose out of necessity because we were having a hard time finding a reliable, regular bass player. So I just kind of offered to take that role, and I'm having a blast.
Meg Farrell and Ryan Whiteside are guests on GLT's Sound Ideas. Meg Farrell and friends at Night Shop in downtown Bloomington this week. All right, Meg, let's go back to you. You moved to France and studied American jazz music.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn in France about one of America's few original art forms?
It's funny. Everyone there said the same thing because I'm from New York. So they're like, you're from New York City? And
right.
Why are you? It was more, at the time, I was not in pursuit of jazz. I was in pursuit of being a better songwriter. I've been studying classical theory, and I thought to be, you know, when it comes down to it, jazz theory is much more relatable to, you know, writing modern music because, like, you know, the way the chord changes are and the way that jazz changes work, it just was, closer. So I thought I should learn stuff about jazz because it'll help my musicianship, not expecting to actually become a jazz musician at all. It was mainly to move to France, and I wanted to study jazz, and it was kind of a way for me to do that.
There's another French connection. We were talking about France. There's another French connection on this album with the song Drunk in the Style of Descartes. Was Descartes someone you were drawn to when you were studying in school? Or
that song is actually a very old song. There's two songs on Fear Nothing that I wrote when I was like 18 and 19. And it's Drunk in the Style of Descartes and Sombrero. Sombrero was one of the first songs I ever wrote. But Drunk in the Style of Descartes is a line from the book Nausea by Jean-Paul Sartre. I was like, if I'm not going to go to school, I'll just be my own professor. And so I gave myself a reading list of like a bunch of French philosophers. And I was reading Descartes and Sartre. And I really became like obsessed with Nausea, and I read it like numerous times that year, and I was reading it while I was traveling through France, and I had this kind of dramatic thing in France, you know, like young silly, I don't know, people in France. And I was by myself one day, and I decided, I was like, went to Jim Morrison's grave, and I brought a bottle of whiskey and a pack of cigarettes, and I like chilled by Jim Morrison's grave and wrote and stuff and walked around Père Lachaise. And then I came back to my apartment, and I was like kind of drunk, and I was like, I'm gonna write a song like Jim, man. And I just like scratched this song together, and it's kind of like incoherent, as you can kind of tell the way the song is. And I wrote it the next day. I basically pieced this song together, and it became Drunk in the Style of Descartes.
All things that I say, they mean nothing, I swear, but things I believe do mean something. I dare. Don't care for me, baby, don't get confused.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton with Meg Farrell and Ryan Whiteside of Meg Farrell and Friends at Night Shop this week. Meg, Ryan has been with you with Sweet Meg and the Wayfarers. You guys were romantically involved, and you're just musically intertwined all the way. What does Ryan bring to the table for you musically and or in this new incarnation?
I'm more of the creative mind, and like I've studied in music, but not in the same way that Ryan has. Ryan's been studying music. He's got a master's degree in it. So it's like, his knowledge of theory and harmony is a lot deeper than mine. So with this band, he's got a very specific role because he's playing bass, but he also helps with the harmonies. Like, that was honestly one of the main reasons I hired him for the band. Because I was originally, we were actually actively trying to not have another band together so we could like have our own things, but we just end up in the same thing all the time. But he was such a good harmony singer, and it comes down to it's like, I need a bass player, but I also wanted someone, because all these old country songs have killing three-part harmonies. Like, that's the thing. Like, they have really good harmonies. And I was doing some of these Emmylou Harris songs, and he just can pick up harmonies so well, and he's got such a like a nice tone with his voice. And it's great for backup singing because he's got like a mellow tone, and it blends so well with mine. And we're starting to write together as well. I'm trying to get him more involved with the songwriting so that I could kind of take some of his, you know, a little bit more of his complex harmonies into the country music. So I'm not just, you know, always writing 1-4-5-6-2, whatever, you know.
Ryan, I didn't know you have any vocal game or learning something new about you.
Yeah, I think I've always liked singing, but I think maybe I got more serious about it when I started playing with Pokey Lafarge, because I sang a lot of backup vocals in that band, and that kind of gave me the bug. And so now, I mean, now I'm practicing voice. Meg's got me on a nice practice routine for me, like a warm-up routine. And so I'm actually starting to treat voice as another instrument rather than just kind of a thing I casually do on the side.
Ryan Weisheit and Meg Farrell speaking via Skype with GLT's John Norton from their home in Brooklyn. Meg Farrell and friends, including Weisheit, plays Night Shop in downtown Bloomington Wednesday evening. You can discover more local music and hear from artists playing in central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Ryan Denham. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. Also look at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet your comments. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.